Elevate your dining experience with Rack Porcelain USA. As the exclusive tableware brand for the Walk and Talk podcast, Rack combines exceptional craftsmanship with innovative design. Whether you're a chef, a restaurant owner, or a food enthusiast, Rack's high-quality porcelain products will enhance every meal. Discover the artistry of food presentation and make every dining occasion special. Visit rackporcelain.com today and see how Rack can transform your table. You've just stepped inside the Walk and Talk podcast, number one in the nation for food lovers, chefs, and storytellers. I'm Carl Fiadini, your host, shining a light on the flavor, the hustle, and the heart of the industry. We're the official podcast for the New York, California, and Florida restaurant shows, the Pizza Tomorrow Summit, the U.S. Culinary Open at NAFM, and the North American media platform for the Burnt Chef Project. Recorded at Ibis Images Studios, where food photography comes alive, and I get the first bite. Find out more info at thewalkandtalk.com. Today's episode is about real food and the people behind it. Our featured guest is Douglas Raggio, founder of Pasta Honey, a company redefining what clean, single-source honeycomb should look like. For years, the honey industry has been clouded by confusion, from unclear sourcing to inconsistent quality. And Douglas is working to bring clarity, transparency, and regeneration back to the process. Joining us in the kitchen is Chef Josh Bernstein. He's a dear friend of the show and of mine. He's a Florida-based chef who grew up fishing with his father and now brings that deep connection to the ocean into every dish he creates. Today, he's cooking two dishes, one using Pasta Honey honeycomb and the other with Aussie Select Lamb, while sharing how his childhood shaped his values in and out of the kitchen. It's a conversation about sourcing, storytelling, and the people who make food more than just something we eat.
My man. Chef Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carl. It's a pleasure to be back.
It's been a minute. It's been like a year.
It has been. Too long.
What'd you call me?
You heard me.
Okay. All right, so listen, you did stuff today. All of it was fantastic and beautiful. Why don't you start with the first dish?
Pasta honey. I tell you what, that was amazing. The best honey I've ever tried in my life. I mean, you think that you've had honey before until you've actually been past the honey. That honey was amazing. Very savory, very clean, not sugar taste to it. I mean, I don't know how to really describe it. You have to try it yourself. It was, as a chef, I was very, very impressed with that dish. We paired that dish today with some roasted beets and some spicy pecans, gorgonzola cheese, a champagne citrus vinaigrette, and some Florida citrus orange, along with some frisée salad. And I got to tell you, I was very impressed. It was really good.
It was one of the most colorful dishes I think we've had in-house. John, yeah?
I got a head shake. That's good enough.
That means it's true. At the end of the day, you picked the right ingredients for that dish to kind of pair with the honeycomb. It was wonderful. So with that said, I've been doing this a lot lately. I kind of feel bad. John, you did it again. Photography, outstanding. Someday you're going to talk. It'll happen. It's going to happen. Silent John. Josh, explain the next dish.
So I had the opportunity to cook with an Aussie Select lamb product, fully cooked product. And I chose the prime rib version of the Aussie lamb. And I'm glad I did, because the dish that we created with it was a lamb Wellington. And when you think Wellington, have you ever really thought lamb? Probably not. But I got to tell you, it was pretty cool, man.
When you told me you were going to do a Wellington, you were almost like, man, you, what did you say? You were like, man, this is kind of old school, whatever.
Yeah.
And I said, no, you're taking a classic and you're turning it around and you're doing something completely different with it. Because who the hell has done lamb, cured lamb in a Wellington?
I would venture to say I'm probably maybe the first one to do so.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, but I think this might edge that, might sink just across the goal line. Right. I think you did it. Just saying.
And we did the traditional mushroom gepsel, the prosciutto, the parma, and what we paired it with, lamb. Traditionally, a lot of people have mint jelly, some sort of mint with it. And so we made a blueberry mint demi to go with it. And we paired that with some tri-colored caramelized carrots and some pearl squash and zucchini. I just thought the dish went really well together. And when we sliced that Wellington in half, when you got that pink, dark red color you were looking for from a pre-cooked product, mind you, it just mind-blowing. It was awesome. I can't wait to see the pictures when they come out. I know it's going to look great.
And it tasted wonderful. You know, people, I know that when someone listens to this podcast, like regularly, like we have, you know, hey, listeners, thank you, appreciate y'all. When people listen to this and they go, yeah, this guy's always saying that everything is great. It is. But there's a reason for that. Because everybody that we bring in-house, they're professionals. Like, we do vetting. There's a vetting process. I know Josh. I know what he does. Chef is amazing. So I knew whatever he was going to do today was going to be a home run. But even past that, when somebody comes into the building and we do what we do, we already know what's coming. It's not like we're taking a chance. It's a guess. There's a lot that goes into the engine of production. So, freaking love you, man. Thanks for coming out today.
Carl, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Isn't this fun?
Yeah, I tell you what. When you called me and said, would you like to do this again? I made sure I canceled everything I had today.
You literally did.
I did.
I know.
I did. I had to cancel quite a few things today, but it was worth it.
All right. So listen, you know, Douglas Raggio, you made it to Florida, to Tampa from New York. And number one, sincerely appreciate you making that trip to be on the program. Number two, sincerely appreciate you coming on board with us as a brand partner. I'm going to say something before I introduce you. I'm going to drop a nugget here. I'm dropping a bomb. Douglas Raggio is going to be the second podcast under the Walk and Talk umbrella. Of course, the name of his company is called Pass the Honey. And you can rest assured that the podcast is called Pass the Honey Podcast. Douglas, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I mean,
I'm excited.
Tell me
about it. It feels weird to hear.
Isn't it weird to hear?
Yeah.
Was it weird to come here?
I mean, it's been a week. I'm not gonna shy away from that. But yeah, I'm very glad I came. So it was meeting Chef, meeting John, seeing you guys in action, seeing the production, you know, behind the scenes. It's impressive.
We do a lot of prep work before you guys ever make it here. And thank you. And in the end, what we're really trying to do, impress the audience and impress you guys, the guests. Pass the Honey. How did it actually come to life? What were you doing before you decided to literally jump in with the bees?
If I'm amping up the drama, I will say I was hating my life. Previously, I had a venture capital fund and a private equity fund. Thought I was going to create all these independent food brands. Turns out venture capital just further consolidates the food system. I then scuttled that and then created a private equity group to kind of create independent businesses. And then we took in a really toxic investor. We had to fire sale the company. And in that time, I was getting run down and I was making honey, lemon, ginger teas, trying to keep my immunity up. Most consumers go to buy honey for its nutritional benefits. It's kind of legacy of healing, if you will. Around that same time, I had watched an episode of Netflix's Rotten, and the first episode was on honey fraud, and I learned that there's just an insane amount of fraud in the honey industry. And here I was seeking out health benefits in my honey, lemon, ginger teas, putting highly questionable liquid honey into my honey. So I thought, oh, I'll choose honeycomb. Went and bought some. It was really expensive, and I nicked a bit, and at that point, I put it on the counter and thought I'd come back to it tomorrow, and I came back the next day, and it was an ant farm, and I was like, well, shoot, there went, you know, $30. And committed to my integrity of my honey, I decided I was going to go and buy another one, you know, spend another $30, and haha, I'm going to put it in the fridge. That'll outsmart the ants. No one's slacking honeycomb. You're going to go nick some. And that was really thinking, like, why isn't this convenient? You know, how can we, if that's the fullest integrity and the fullest flavor of true honey, why isn't it convenient? And that was really the genesis of the company. And from there, I thought I could make some mailbox money with some patents and just license it to beekeepers. And then I couldn't find a beekeeper in the United States to sell us honeycomb because there's pesticide accumulation in the wax. And that was really disheartening. It's thinking, oh, wow, I can't even buy it in the States. That's bizarre. And you peel that onion a little bit more, and there's no organic standards for honey because you can't fence or feed a bee in organics based on inputs. And it's like, well, that's even more bizarre because I see it on jars. Then you peel the onion again and you realize, oh, wow, beekeepers are going out of business because all the fraudulent imports are driving the prices down that they can't make a living any longer. And it's like, well, shoot, that's also, you know, another crappy situation. And if you look at all of it, it's like, well, how can we actually stabilize beekeeping as an industry? Because our modern food system is based on it. Like, without a honeybee, we don't have a bounty of food that chefs like Chef Josh can make delicious meals. And so all those things kind of came together at various points in time, and we decided we were just going to make a change. And that was creating a conveniently formatted honeycomb for consumers and chefs. And if you make something convenient, a la the baby carrot, you can start to increase consumption. We can also educate a little bit more. We can engage consumers, diners in the food service realm. And you know, the honeycomb, people haven't seen it in a while. It's kind of fallen off the radar. So we're bringing it back. Like sexy.
Have to bring sexy back. We also have to bring back more beekeepers.
100%.
And how do we do that?
You give them a way to make money and have a living. No one's passing generational beekeeping operations down any longer. It's like farming. It's this kind of weird, sad, dying industry that we all depend on that no one seems to take any sort of long-term view on. It's not really a priority per se.
But what's the pathway to get that done?
For us, I feel that honeycomb is a wedge. Honeycomb is a wedge to change the conversation, to change the consumer's awareness and perception of honey, because it's a pattern interrupt. People haven't seen honeycomb in that format. They were used to seeing honey in a little teddy bear that's super cute, and that's like the nemesis of our business. If we can sell more honeycomb, we can give beekeepers a product that they can sell at a price that they can have a life on. That would be my, like, that's catalyst one, right? And then you have the ripple effect from that. It's the, if we can have that item that beekeepers can have a stable income, we then can then move to educating consumers on honey fraud. Like, why does this honeycomb taste different? Chef Josh, you know, he made a comment. He said, this tastes like unlike anything I've had.
So what is the biggest misconception about honey? You know, it's in every store. You mentioned the cute teddy bear. What are we missing?
The biggest misconception is that the honey you're buying is honey. I think if I had to back it all up, the consumer's been defrauded for decades. The numbers are staggering. It's 80% of all liquid honey is actually fraudulent. And by fraudulent, I mean it's been cut with other processed sugars. They cut it like drugs. So for a consumer that's seeking out the nutritional benefits, like myself, you're not getting that. You're essentially having a candy bar, which is why people experience crashes as well. That and the honey is cheap and freebie. And people are giving out little honey sachets. And honey comes from the earth. It comes from flowers. It comes from terroir. So would you expect wine to be free? No. But yet here's honey that has all this nuance and health benefits and history and flavor. And you know, the insect that creates it is integral to our food system.
How is there an organic symbol on a honey if it's unquantified?
Valid question. You ask the USDA and the National Organic Program, the NOP, and there are no apiculture standards because, again, you can't fence or feed a bee. However, there has been proposed guidance, and I put up my quote fingers on that, of qualifying honey as livestock because it's kept. You can still feed a cow. You can't fence a bee or feed a bee. So if you look at things like pesticide adjacencies, you can have a pristine 10 acres. Right next door, somebody could be spraying whatever they're spraying. You could have somebody 2 miles away, 10 miles away, spraying, and it comes into the wind pattern. So the sheer amount of landscape research we have to do, landscape management practices we have to do, before we even get to beekeeping practices, to just qualify that it's pure honey without some sort of contaminant in it is difficult. And we're losing forage zone as well.
Isn't that something where they're able to run tests on the actual honey itself?
We do.
Honeycomb, where it's coming from?
Yeah, we do nuclear magnetic resonance testing. It's like an MRI for food. It's the highest level of testing you can do for any food. And we look for pesticides, contaminants. We do it to the parts per billion, which is 1,000 times more stringent than organic standards. We also look for sugar water feeding, because that's another way of adulteration. And then we do a pollen analysis that we match to regions that we've qualified that are removed from industrial agriculture.
Wouldn't then, in that testing, it would show some levels of pesticide?
What I've been told from the lab is you never get a zero. So there is always some level of something. But again, to the parts per billion, it's coming at 0.000, whatever the heck the number is.
So does that mean that the companies with the organic stamp are going off of this analysis, or is it cover their eyes and rubber stamp it?
So here's the upside down manner of organic is that it's all practice based. It's disclosed. So I get a sheet and it says, this is what I do. And this is what it fits. It's like a rubric, right? We look at outcomes. So our regenerative standards are outcomes based. We test before, during, after for honeybee health, beekeeper livelihoods, and ecological diversity. We're still figuring out the tests on the last one, but making sure beekeepers are paid a fair living wage, making sure the honeybees are kept safe and that they're not, you know, being exposed to pesticide stress, mites, all the other stuff that happens in the beekeeping industry, which is why we decided not to go after the organic. So your original question was, how is organic on bottles? There are certifying agencies that certify things as organic. They're using livestock guidance as the honeybee guidance. It doesn't line up. And I don't know why it's still on jars, because it shouldn't be, because it doesn't fit. If you ask the group that came up with the program that says it doesn't exist, but then you have other groups that are third parties that are, you know, charging money for things, I'm uncertain. So early on, we decided just to sidestep it all. It's like, this is such a mess. No regulatory guidance, no, you know, U.S. domestic sourcing at volume that we could find. Huge level of fraud. The role of the honeybee, we just decided we're going to work with UC Davis and we're going to create regenerative standards, our own quality standards. And from that moment, we started involving the industry. And we did a white paper with like 350 different apiculture experts. And we got some million acres for research, and a lot of other things are going into it. It's a total mess.
So as you're doing that, how long were you in business already with Pasta Honey?
Pasta Honey... The patent work took about a year and a half. The supply chain standards and practices with UC Davis took about a year and a half. And those were in parallel. It took us another year and a half just to find a source that met our standards. And now we're at the point where we're building the supply as well as building demand. So we're having to balance both sides of the equation.
So it sounds to me that there was foresight in the specific area of making sure that the product is at its highest quality, that it's actually real honeycomb, real honey. From the rip, ran out of the gate.
Yeah, it seemed wrong. It seemed totally wrong that this was this industry that had this total underbelly that no one seemed to know about or care about.
So when you decided one day, hey, honey, let's do honey, honey. When you did that, obviously you already knew that there were some challenges. What else stood out?
Honest answer? I thought I could make a quick buck with licensing a patent. And then you start to learn these things and you're like, wow, that's interesting. And had I known everything I know now, then I probably wouldn't have gone forward, because I thought that's too much. But lucky for me, unlucky for me, I guess, it was kind of drip fed to me. And so as we progressed further and we saw the market opportunity and we saw kind of the catalyst for change and the ability to change the conversation, when do you get a chance to reintroduce an entire generation to something that's been around for millions of years? And the fact that younger adults, you know, 30 and below even, don't know what honeycomb is. And we're like, that's a pretty unique position to be in, to say, here, this is what this is. It's like introducing the avocado 20, 30 years ago.
So in a strange twist of events, obviously I know what honeycomb is. I'm not a kid either, but because of Past the Honey, you know, we actually started work on a short film, short documentary, and we did the trailer. And in over the course of a weekend, Douglas and I had a conversation, and we said, "Yeah, let's do this." I said, "Okay," and I started calling around. I called my cinematographer, and simultaneously, I get a call from a friend of mine, and they say, "Hey, go try this restaurant in Plant City. It's called Propagation Whiskey Bar." the kitchen. I said, okay, cool. Same day, end up going to dinner. I see the bartender, which was, you know, this documentary is going to have a cocktail element to it with the honeycomb. Beautiful bar. Bartender looked pretty cool. So I went over and introduced myself. Turns out he's the bar manager. Long story short, I explained what we were doing. He's all in. 20 minutes later, owner comes over. We're talking. He's all in. And I'm like, well, I just need to find beekeepers. He goes, wait a minute. I know a guy. I'm like, man, it's 10 o'clock at night. What do we know, guy? He says, come with me. I'm like, we're in Plant City. What are you talking about? It's Plant City. It's 10:30. Like, what are we doing here? So we end up going to a mead bar and we get introduced to the owner. He used to do hives. Well, he says, well, I don't do hives anymore. I don't beekeep anymore, but I know a guy. And I said, okay, great. By Monday, I had met a beekeeper and it was somewhere in Lakeland. Really nice guy. And Mike, he hooks me up with his mentor, John.
That's cool.
Coolest thing ever. By Wednesday, we're shooting. Within 5 days, we had the trailer. It was like a 2 or 3 minute trailer. And it's badass. And this came from you and me.
Here's the thing. Beekeeping is out there. It's always been there. It's been around for centuries, right? But it's like under the radar. And it's a very welcoming community. It's very, you know, they understand the role they play in the food system. Other people know they're important, but don't know per se as to why they're important. And that's what we are. We're trying to bridge that gap, that knowledge gap.
Why are they important?
I think bees pollinate 1/3 of our food system. So if you want berries and almonds and mangoes and any other thing that looks delicious on a plate other than a root vegetable, we kind of owe it to them.
Are you telling me that without bees, we don't get mangoes? Is that what you're saying?
It's a vast majority of fruits and vegetables are pollinated by bees, honeybees in particular.
Obviously, I'm playing with you a little bit, but you know, yeah, I mean, it's a huge thing.
Things get real boring without honeybee. Real boring. Chef over here is not going to be jazzed about his dishes if he's working with just a yam every day.
That's the truth. Since we've met, Douglas, I see beekeepers. You know, I'm driving. You know, we're kind of country where we're at. So I'm driving and I'm like, oh, look, you know, an apiary. Oh, look, beekeeper. It's pretty cool. So I actually got to put on the bee suit and the whole thing. And it's probably one of the best experiences that I've had.
Were you intimidated at first?
So I don't know. I still don't know, but I guess I'm not now. I don't know if I'm allergic to...
You'd know.
Normally, I eat honey. For the last 5 years, I eat honey and I break out. I just as well assume that if I got stung by a bee, I might have a reaction. So I've always just kind of been aware of that. And every now and again, I'm like, well, I don't care. I like honey. I want to have some. And then I break out. Miraculously, lately, I've been eating honey and it doesn't happen. Certainly doesn't happen with your honeycomb. So we go to we're at the apiary and I'm dressed up and I'm like, okay, I'm not scared, but I'm aware. Like, okay.
Hyper aware.
I'm acutely aware. Like, all right, I hope there's an EpiPen around. I don't know. I'm like, who knows? But the bees were in good spirits. They were not aggressive. They were very docile that day. And, you know, I got to actually move the crate around, open the, you know, pull out the comb. And, you know, we're actually dipping our finger, you know, with the glove on, has a glove on, you know, dipping the thing in there. And through the net, you're tasting the honey. My God, it was the coolest experience I ever had.
Yeah,
it really was. Like, I've never done anything like that in my life. There was an intimidation factor, but mostly because I didn't want the ambulance coming. You know, I have a little bit of pride with that. I don't want to be rolled out. So, yes.
Congrats.
Thank you.
On being a pseudo beekeeper.
I was being a pseudo beekeeper.
Hans
Douglas. But, okay, so all of that's great. Why is it that pass the honey? What makes your honey any different than somebody else's? Why is your honeycomb different?
One is the format. You know, making it convenient. So eliminating the need for a knife or skilled labor or portioning or, you know, waste. I ended up throwing half of mine away, which was really irritating. That would be kind of the first and foremost, the regenerative standards, you know, a company that's actually putting their money where their mouth is and doing real work. I mean, having a full 501c3 behind us and 1 million acres for research, a company of our size shouldn't be able to do that. But it's because we're doing real work, working with groups like the Culinary Institute of America, doing things like a history of honey course for them, a honey concentration, brand partnerships with both like consumer brands, like a big spirits brand we're working with for their gins, their bourbons, and their Proseccos as a garnish, working with operators. Because we have the 501c3, it's an awesome opportunity to do an LTO. You know, my dream is like the Waffle House or something, or Pancake IHOP, and saying, do you want a honeycomb on that? And a percentage of proceeds going back to the pollen research. And it's real research. It's not just, you know, 1% for the planet. And where does that go? No one really knows.
Well, the fact that you're having the work you're doing as part of any university curriculum, so when we first met, that was one of the more interesting things, because that shows it's different than credibility. It's more than credibility.
It's just cool to be able to say you're doing a history of honey course about the history of apiculture and agriculture and the role of honeybees and beekeepers in our food system with the emerging chefs of, you know, the world is an insane opportunity. And there's scholarships with that. There's externships associated with that. We have an apiary on campus that students will get their hands dirty. They'll do what you did. It's my lifetime like legacy, I think. Me and my wife.
It's just cool.
It's just cool, period, yeah.
Douglas, you talk a lot about regeneration. And I don't know that the average person is going to really wrap their brain around that just because it's not part of a, you know, vernacular for most people. What is that?
So regenerative as a term has not been defined. It's not owned like organic. My take is that we leave it better than we found it. I want to leave beekeepers in a better position. I want to leave the hives in a better position. I want to leave the regions in which we're harvesting in a better position. And honey and bees in particular have a unique ability to do that. You can't say that as much as others, perhaps. So that's our take on regenerative. Now, we're also, I mentioned earlier, we're the outcomes-based camp. There's also a practice-based camp that kind of layers on top of organic. And for us, organic doesn't exist, so that wasn't even an option. Also, the sheer levels of fraud in the honey industry kind of just pushed us in the direction of testing, to your earlier question.
So why is it that chefs like Josh are important in helping consumers rediscover and reimagine honeycomb?
Chefs drive culinary exploration. They drive trends. They show consumers ways to use unique items. Chefs also know what honeycomb is. They don't have to educate them on why it is or where it's from. I think even above all that, I came from the CPG world. It's a lot of kids with MBAs looking to make a quick buck, you know, build it and sell it type stuff. And there just isn't substance there. Not the majority of those brands. And that, you know, coming from a world like that into a world of agriculture and the culinary world, it's all steak and no sizzle. Like, there's work to be done, and we don't need to, you know, wax poetic about things, but let's, you know, let's do some good work. Let's feed some people. Let's make an impact. And it's authentic. And so not only is my natural desire, I prefer working with people in the agriculture industry and the culinary industry, but if we're looking to usher in a new paradigm of honeycomb as the IX avocado, chefs are the only way that's going to happen. So working with chefs like Josh to do a salad, yep, the general consumer is not going to think to put honeycomb on a salad. They're still in the, like, I'm going to put it on a charcuterie board level. I'm going to start getting honeycomb toasts and honeycomb on pancakes and waffles and acai bowls and on top of steaks and on cocktails. Like, we're a complement to other things. Like, that's our role. We're a zhuzh, if you will, to use a culinary term. So yeah, working with chefs is an absolute no-brainer. And it's a group of individuals that I naturally gravitate to. How my wife's a chef, or a soon-to-be chef. She's in this culinary school. So I don't want to disrespect any chefs out there while saying that. Or disrespect her.
For sure not disrespecting.
I mean, you've got landmines at every turn with that last one. Josh, from a chef's perspective, How do you follow that?
I agree 100%. I mean, I believe that the normal consumer is not going to go to a grocery store and see a honeycomb and say, I'm going to go make a salad out of it. I'm going to top it on a steak with some gorgonzola blue cheese or No, you know, when see what he did there? He just zhuzhed up the zhuzh.
Zhuzhed. I zhuzhed it.
So Nicola no, I think that getting it out there and giving people the knowledge and showing them how versatile this type product can be is super important. So I can agree and understand wholeheartedly why he would want to work with chefs in the industry and get his product out there.
And if we're taking a business tact here, a consumer, you talk about solving pain points with businesses. The consumer doesn't have a pain point. They don't know about honey fraud. They don't have that yearning to understand. But chefs have real pain points. They need to, you know, get bigger tickets. They need to have things that work in the back of house. They have to have things that don't muck up the line. So to go to a chef and say, look, here's a $5 to $10 upsell across all parts of your menu. Use it as a topper. And you're going to get $5 to $10 on every ticket. And no knife, no skilled labor, and no waste at the end of service. It doesn't have expiration. Like, those are things that a chef's going to light up about. The general consumer, you know, is a general consumer.
Chef, you grew up in Jacksonville. You come from a fishing family.
Correct.
You love the seafood.
Love it.
You're a chef. You have to be creative. I know that you love to prepare fish and seafood. So something like honeycomb would probably work terrifically in some application.
Absolutely.
How? Well, thank you. That was my next question.
Well, I think that... you touched on this earlier before that, or Douglas touched on this earlier before, it's a compliment to the dish mostly. And so when I get something like honey that I know is going to be sweet, and honestly, this honey was sweet and savory, which was really unique. I would get something spicy, maybe a blackened mahi-mahi over a, some sort of nice rice pilaf with a mango relish. And in that mango relish, we incorporate his honey. You know, just to top it off would be amazing. You know, I just dreaming and salivating about something like that right now. It makes me want to go fishing right now and catch a fresh mahi and make a mango relish with his honey.
Did you just see what he just did?
It's insane. No, you have to understand something. This is, when we have conversations, this is what he does. And it gets me hopped up. I am a mirror to the people who I'm with. So if the three of you were duds, I'm going to dud out too. When the energy is there and he's coming to me like, you know, like we spoke. I said, he said, look, well, who's the guest? What's it going to be? What are we cooking? Whatever. And I start giving him data points.
I wasn't qualifying you, chef.
He started rattling off all sorts of amazing sounding dishes. He threw so many at me and he's like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, I can't process what you just said to me. I can't even do it.
Will it pull you off track for this podcast if we explore his creative brain? I mentioned it earlier and you said that we could talk about it. Is now that time?
It is absolutely that time. This man is an avid fisherman, a tournament fisherman. And when he gets to go out, and I don't want to speak for you, but when he goes out on the boat, he gets to clear his head. He gets to talk about, you know, regeneration. This guy does that, and he comes back with like this fire. And that's what I really appreciate. So there's a lot of chefs that we deal with, and everybody has their superpowers. That is this man's superpower. And he's fast. He's quick on the draw with the creativity.
Thank you, Carl.
You're welcome. So, chef.
Yes, Doug.
You just riffed on a dish that I never, ever would have thought of. And we work with a lot of people on developing recipes and no one else has come up with that. And you came up with it in 30 seconds flat.
So when someone gives you a hero ingredient, in this case, honeycomb, where's the first place your brain goes? Like if you have a rubric of building a dish, do you start with the flavor profiles? Do you start with texture? Do you start with presentation? Like how do you navigate coming to a finished dish?
All the above. You know, definitely, you know, texture, you know, flavor profiles, you know, understanding where the product's coming from. You know, and you start thinking about, you know, as a chef, you start thinking about a million different ways that you can incorporate this product into a dish. And, you know, that's what I do.
I don't know, man. I think
how'd you land on a salad? How'd you land on a salad of all things?
Well,
what I was thinking about was cheese, nuts, you know, because when you think honey, like we talked about earlier, the safe bet and the quick suggestion everybody else has is charcuterie.
Yeah.
You know, and so you start thinking about certain components on charcuterie board, and, you know, I was like, well, what about a salad? You know, and what really inspired me was when we were talking about the bees, I thought flowers right away. And so when I was creating the dish in my head, which I do a lot, I started thinking, how can we make this look like a flower on the plate? And so colorful, you know, so root vegetables, the frisée lettuce, citrus from here in the state of Florida, you know. And so I started putting all those components together in my head, and I dreamed of putting that honeycomb right on top of that. Realistically, it's the center of the flower, and that's what I wanted it to be, was the center of the flower. The center of the dish was the honeycomb, because it's the center of the flower.
Josh, when you told me one of the dishes was a salad, now I trust you,
right?
Okay. It isn't like we've never met before, and right, it's not like I haven't had your food. But when you told me a salad, I was a little deflated at first.
The truth.
It's the truth. I'm like, oh, man.
Pulling no punches today.
I was like, man, this is, oh. But I said, wait a minute. Know, this is not like, this isn't some Cracker Jack chef, whatever. This is Josh. I know he's going to be creative with this. So I said, well, tell me the ingredients. And he starts running down the ingredients list. And I'm like, okay, wait, this sounds really interesting. And then he finished it with, Carl, it's going to be in the shape of a flower.
Boom.
I already knew that he was in another level with this. You know, he went Matrix on it. And I was like, all right, cool. Sounds awesome.
He nailed it.
Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, it's the bee. It's the pollinator. It's, you know, it's about the flowers, you know, and so that's what I was thinking.
And then he says to me, he says, well, you know, Carl, the other dish, it's kind of like, I don't know. I know it's played out and it's like an old school, but I was like, don't say that. What are you talking about? And he's like, well, I want to do the Wellington, but with the lamb, with the Aussie Select lamb. I go, that's brilliant. You're taking a classic and you're doing something that, honestly, I don't know that I've ever seen anyone take a cured lamb loin and use it for a Wellington. That's crazy. So originally when he says that, and I said, okay, I'm okay with that. But then when he starts describing it, and I'm like, oh man, these are both going to be
the whole is greater than the parts, or
yeah, absolutely. That's for sure.
And tying it to a flower is, that's no pun intended, the chef's kiss.
I mean,
that is the, our honeycomb is the flavor. That's what flowers taste like. It's where it comes from. If we don't touch it, it boggles my mind that a bee pollinated tens of thousands of flowers for that one bite of honeycomb.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing's touched it till it hits your tongue. Like, we just cut it from the hive. You asked questions earlier, you know, like, is this just cut? Yeah, it's cut and packed. No processing. Bee makes it.
And as a chef, we can appreciate that, you know. To get food that is not so processed, it's fresh. And this is, you know, Carl and I were talking, this is why I really embrace fishing and love fishing and have my whole life, because I know where I'm sourcing my food from. I know what I'm putting in my family's bellies. You know, to go offshore 20, 30 miles and bring back a species that's indigenous to the state of Florida and come home and cook it myself and prepare it myself. There's nothing better than that. You know, you can't go to a grocery store and take that piece of salmon or that piece of grouper out of the display there and take it home and know that fish was 2-3 days old. I mean, these boats go out for 8 to 12 days sometimes. And you don't know if that fish was caught 7 days ago, 8 days ago, and then how long was it to process it, you know? So
that connection to like the origin is clutch.
So knowing that honeycomb that we cooked with today was not processed at all. You know, we talked about how it wasn't heated. It wasn't, there was nothing done to it. It was put in a package, sealed, and delivered to my hand. When you eat it, you think about that, and it just makes it taste that much better.
That is and I'm curious from a culinary perspective, when you're serving guests, diners, guests, whatever, I've never seen anybody interact with a garnish like they do with honeycomb. And it's a lot of that. Like, you want to talk about educating and engaging consumers and guests. For a wait staff to say, would you like a honeycomb on that? What is a honeycomb might come up, which gives you that little door opens up, right, to educate. Mm-hmm. When they're tasting it, the taste is different. Well, that's a regenerative honeycomb. That is the true taste of honey. What you're getting in the store may not be. That level of interaction table side is, I think, lost a lot.
1,000%.
So if we can play a role with chefs to re-engage the consumer, the guest, the diner, in something that they may not have seen if they're an older generation, they'll start telling you stories of their youth. It's bizarre. Oh, my neighbor had one. I was a kid. And all of a sudden the kid's storytelling comes up. And I've watched a grandmother and a granddaughter in a coffee shop by one. And the granddaughter had no clue what it was. And the grandma started telling them stories of their youth. And the granddaughter asked the questions that most young kids ask. What is it? What do you do with it? Can you eat it? You know, how do you get the honey in there? But it was mind-boggling to see those just drastically different experiences with those, that age demographic. And we get asked, who's your demographic? It's like, well, who's the demographic for a banana? Like, I don't know. We're a commodity.
Right.
And yeah. What are the uses for a banana? Well, they're pretty limitless. Same with honeycomb. You can use it with fish. You can use it on a salad. You can use it on a cocktail. Like, we haven't seen an end in sight, which is so weird. It breaks everything I've known about business and CPG. You know, just talk about quality.
Yeah.
Talk about how you pay your producers. You know, talk about your impact on the earth and the ecosystem. Draw the consumer into that story somehow, some way.
I agree 100%.
Chef, you've studied commercial fishing in high school. That's not typical. I haven't even heard of anything like that before. Talk a little bit about that. And how that kind of, you know, breadcrumbed your way into your chef life.
Yeah, so it's not very typical and pretty much unheard of. I started my ninth grade year of high school in Jacksonville at Fletcher. And I remember my teacher coming in and putting a pamphlet down on the table and telling everybody, hey, you know, this is an OJT program on job training. You can go and be a plumber or electrician, you know, things of that nature. And I took the pamphlet. I'm like, I'm not doing any of that. And I flipped it upside down and threw it on the table. On the very back, it said commercial fishing. And I, of course, it piqued my interest. I was already a fisherman, grew up fishing with my father. And I picked up the pamphlet and asked the teacher, I said, is this real? And she said, yes. So I took the opportunity and I was bused my ninth and 10th grade year to Marine Science Center in Mayport, Jacksonville. And we learned, and then 11th, 12th grade year, I drove there myself. But we learned commercial vision and we learned about boats and motors and the ocean and how to preserve the ocean. We learned all about fish and different types of fish and how to clean fish and how to utilize every part of the fish. It was really cool, but I started working on day boats while I was out there. So my 11th and 12th grade year in the summer, I worked on head boats and day boats. It was, as a young man, I was making money. I was out with a lot of people catching lots of fish. And I was in the ocean every day. And that was just, it was an amazing experience. Your question was, how did that, you know, get me into the chef world? I really enjoyed the fish. I enjoyed, you know, coming home and creating dishes. I was already working in restaurants part-time as well. And I worked at one particular restaurant at the beach, RP's, and I worked with some really talented cooks / chefs, and it was all about seafood. The quality of the seafood there was bar none. It was amazing to see somebody take a piece of grouper and cut it a certain way and make it taste so amazing on a sandwich, or to take crab and stuff it and bake it with a little breadcrumb on top. And to taste that flavor profile was just, I mean, my mind was blown. And, you know, I was 17, 18 years old, you know, and so I kind of really started getting into it. And, you know, as I told you before, I was really into food when I was younger from my grandparents, you know, always cooking in the kitchen and then everything was from scratch, you know. So to be involved in that environment at such an early age, I knew that was my passion, it was my love, and I was going to do something with it in my life, and here I am.
If we had more programs like that now, I think we'd have a whole different generation of people.
1,000%.
Yeah.
I agree with that, you know, and I feel, you know, I've got a daughter in high school right now, and it's, you know, it's some of the things I hear, some of the things I see, it's, you know, I mean, because let's face it, back in the day, we didn't have technology that
distractions
we had today. You know, there was no cell phone. There was no, you know, TV show that you ran home to watch. It was, you were outdoor.
Talk to us. What's the biggest challenge in helping people to better understand what honey is, where it comes from, honeycomb?
I think that one of the bigger challenges is the honey industry as a whole has been pushed down so hard on the price that the perception is that honey is cheap and should be free. And I say that because when we show up with the real price of honey that's harvested properly, it's more expensive. And certain consumers, I wouldn't say all by any means, but certain consumers think, well, why would I spend that much on a honeycomb? What is it? What do I do with it? It's like those two, like unawareness of the category, the price difference from a 3 cent an ounce liquid honey and a teddy bear and us is drastic. But you're also not buying honeycomb as a sweetener. You're buying it as a snack or a garnish. And so that shift is what we're navigating right now. So when you talk about challenges, it is the challenge that, is it honey or is it honeycomb? Are they one and the same? I don't know. I believe honeycomb is distinctly different than liquid honey because liquid honey has a process to get in the jar and where it loses nutritional benefits. It also has the ability for more fraud to enter the equation. Honeycomb cannot be heated, cannot be blended. It'll break it. So like that singularity alone is what allows us to have that different conversation. But it's still that, is it honey? Is it comb? What do you do with it? That's the difficulty, is just delineating what it even is.
The fact that they'll open a tomb in Egypt and they'll find a jar of 3,000-year-old honey and it's still good, that should be the biggest eye-opener in the history of anything with food about how important it is to have such a product, like, and to actually have beekeepers, to actually have apiaries, to actually put effort into universities and curriculum. I don't know if there's anything else food-wise that can do that.
I don't either. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. But then, you know, we talk about in the culinary world, challenge there is that a lot of chefs, when they first see the comb, and then Chef Josh, I'd love to get your perspective. When you first see it, they start thinking menu cost or meal costs.
Yep.
We're going to break a meal cost pretty quickly, depending on where you're at. I mean, most places, they don't think of it as an upsell or a garnish. The would you like a honeycomb on that? And you know, I mentioned it earlier, the avocado is kind of a template for us. The avocado was funky to eat. They went bad quickly. You almost cut yourself open in the thing. And it was maybe $4 for a slice on a taco, you know, 20 years ago. And now it's honeycomb toast world. So getting chefs to think differently about the ingredient and like, hey, this isn't something you want to tuck into the meal cost. It's something you want to offer your guest as a point of engagement, a point of theater, and a premium positioning. Well, some of the consumer research we did early on was mind-boggling, that it was 65 and older Midwest rural was our primary customer. I would have told you all day, every day up until that point, it was going to be millennial moms on the coasts. Wasn't the case. There was a remembrance of their childhood, the memory of like a nostalgia play. We had a cost-conscious mother that was coming up, like statistically relevant in the data. I thought, well, cost-conscious at $6.99 to $9.99 retail does not, I wouldn't have thought those words would come up. But what we found when we dug deeper was that they were using it to put on toast and breakfast was exciting. They'd put the honeycomb on a toaster waffle and the kids would go crazy about it for breakfast. Like that's the kind of thing that I think has applicability in the food service world, is you can take a very low cost dish like the salad, chef. Now, it wasn't a ton of, you know, pricey ingredients in that thing.
No.
You add the honeycomb and all of a sudden you're not only getting the premium on the salad itself, but you're also getting this kind of extra level of this premium garnish, this elevated garnish that drives the price even further. And the customer doesn't bat an eye at it. And that's where we're trying to navigate with chefs is like, look, think of it as a tool in your toolkit and not something that's going to break the bank.
I think there's going to be a process to get the average chef to understand or have a desire to understand about this. It's going to take time to educate the culinary community because they're beaten over the head on food costs.
100%.
That's the first part. The second part is honeycomb. Even I'm not a young guy and I'm not an old guy, but I'm pretty, you know, over middle aged at this point. I don't know that I've ever had honeycomb before. I can't remember. I know what it is. I've seen it. I don't think I ever had it until now. And what was funny for me, you know, because you sent me samples. I tried. I was like, wow, this is really good. What do I do with this waxy part? And I had this conversation with Mike and John where we shot the documentary. And John says, you eat it, man. He says, you just eat it. It comes out. Don't worry. And I was like, it was something different for me. It was completely off the wall for me. But now I understand, number one, it really is healthy and it isn't something processed. And it's not something like, you know, some of these big, you know, candy companies where all of what they're doing in our sweets and the things that we're consuming in our beverages and all that stuff where it's terrible for you. This is something completely different. And guess what? I pay for extra avocado. I pay for extra bacon. I pay for extra sides. Why the hell wouldn't I want to pay a little bit extra for honeycomb?
Yeah.
That it's not like we can make honeycomb.
People pull out their phones to take pictures of honeycomb. They don't pull out their phones to take pictures of avocados and raspberries.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah, we do that. We do that. But yes.
An average consumer, the average diner.
Honeycomb in and of itself is super cool. So people who actually are into photography, right? Just pop a clutch here, switch a gear. People who are into photography and they look at textures and they look at the colors and they look at how lighting affects all of that. Honeycomb is where it's at. Like it's such a cool thing. You know, John, when you've been shooting a little bit, you know, this honeycomb recently, when the light hits it, it makes for a beautiful photo. It reminds me of the caviar we did a few weeks ago with Parker. The light hits it, it has this like glow, and you see the color spectrum. But then you have to know that came from a little bee. I mean, thousands of bees.
Yeah, tens of thousands.
But it's a bee made. A human can't make that.
Can't.
I don't know.
People try.
True story. And that's what you end up with. You know, in some of these cutesy little bottled products.
I'm curious, when you're creating a menu or a meal and you're considering all the things you got to do, meal costs, you know, head counts, things like that, how much do things like theater engagement and like novelty and newness come into the equation?
Every component of the dish, I'm in 100% on it.
I think about the rice
that's going on the dish. I think about the vegetable that's going on the dish. I think about the protein that's going on the dish and how I'm going to garnish it. What's the garnish going to be? You know, and depending on who my consumer is, depending on where I'm at, depicts whether or not, you know, I can use this high-end product or this high-end product or the environment that I'm in now. I'm price conscious, you know, and so I gotta consider every component that goes on the dish.
No, and that's where it's like I'm still learning the culinary world, right? Like what goes into earning our spot on the menu?
Mm-hmm.
Like what does the chef care about? Obviously, cost is going to be high on that care list. The next thing down might be the way it looks. We score high on that. The next might be a regenerative thing, depending on who they. If it's sweet green, they may care more about than the others. That like first time is where I'm like it's a one that we can't measure. Which is kind of where I'm curious is where that fall in, like in the hopper of creativity.
Food service sales, food service applications, products, establishments, all of that, they play together in a very unique way. And it all depends upon the chef, how long they've been in this game. It depends on the type of establishment, whether it's a bodega,
versus some elevated Michelin restaurant and everything in between versus a cafeteria at a corporation. There's so many different things. A senior living facility where maybe they might be food forward, but they still have to have a boundary. So at the end of the day, every chef who works in the different segments of the food industry have different challenges that they have to, you know, tackle or deal with. Dollars are always the elephant in the room, no matter where you are, unless you're charging $90 a plate or $80 a plate or something. Everybody else has to be in a special sandbox. So as creative as he wants to be or anybody else, it changes the whole fabric. I can't tell you how many times I've gone into a kitchen and I have some really interesting product, whatever it is. And I say, what do you think about this? And they look at it and you can see the disappointment in their face because they want it. They can't even entertain it. And it turns into, that looks great, man. Just don't even tell me about it. Because I can't, how much is that? X, Y, Z price. I don't want to see that. Because they can't, their hands are tied. So it matters on how it's presented to them. If they're in a place that you can upcharge and you can upsell and you can say, hey, this isn't part of your food cost. This is something, it's like a
gravy.
Everything is a la carte. I'm paying extra for mashed potatoes if I want it on my plate. Okay, well, you know what? I want extra bacon. I'm paying for that. Well, you want Honey Club? I'm going to pay for that. So it shouldn't be really attached to your food cost. That should be on the periphery there. Light draw.
Thank you. Very well said. And that goes back to your sandbox comment. Like, that's the sandbox every chef has to work with it.
Correct.
And that's the constraint.
It matters where you're at. You know, and you're in a fine dining restaurant, you have a lot more to play with.
So what's a fish that's going to actually go well with this honeycomb?
I would go ahead and say wahoo. And I would do a raw wahoo with like a sesame honey ginger dressing to go over it.
Nailed it.
Wow.
A raw wahoo. I'd take that all day.
Because of the raw honey. You take the raw fish and the raw honey and you marry them together. It's the bee's knees, brother.
Wow. Talk about mic drop. Okay. Wow. Listen, you guys are freaking amazing. Appreciate you both coming out. How do we find you, Douglas?
LinkedIn, Douglas Raggio.
Chef Life Forever, 1975.
Oh, yeah. Gen X in the house. Listen, everybody, keep your ears open. Stay tuned for Pass the Honey podcast. That is coming to a bee near you, Beehive. Near you, and check out Hospitality Bites with Colleen Silk. She's awesome. The show is awesome. And that is, of course, now housed under the Walk and Talk Media umbrella. People, watch out, because we're coming. We are coming. John, as always, you did great. And you know what's nice? We are out.
Let me tell you about my friends over at Citrus America and their amazing juicing equipment. They're revolutionizing the way you enjoy freshly squeezed juice. They're at the best hotels, restaurants, and markets. Their mission is simple. Develop a unique consumer experience with on-premise juicing, deliver healthy taste options to clientele, and juice more faster. It's that easy. Citrus America supplies the highest quality juicing equipment and solutions in the industry. So whether you're a small business owner or a large corporation, Citrus America has the right juicing equipment for you. Find out more at citrusamerica.com.